Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chissa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening and viewing audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished moderator, Abhijit Phanse, who helped us pull our today's panel. Abhijit Phanse is a technology veteran with CA management, operating and investing experience in technology businesses. Abhijit is the CEO of United Layer, a premier North American co-location and managed hosting provider, with co-location data center facilities, virtual private clouds, managed hosted platforms in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Toronto, and a nationwide high-performance IPv4, V6 network backbone. Abhijit is also the managing partner of Axelon Capital, a private equity firm investing in growth stage companies. Previously, Abhijit was the co-founder and CEO of Sintera, the leading provider of chipsets for high-performance wireless base stations. Prior to starting Sintera, Abhijit held management positions at National Semiconductor, where he led the development and commercialization of Ethernet networking products. Abhijit has an MS in management from Stanford Business School, an MS in electrical engineering from the University of Central Florida, and a BTech in electrical engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. He has authored numerous publications and has over 50 U.S. patents. Abhijit will introduce our distinguished panel.
Thank you, Chisako, for organizing this panel discussion, and thank you, everybody, for graciously being here today. It is my great honor to introduce an incredibly distinguished panel of industry luminaries. And let me start with Timothy Chu, Simon Crosby, and Gina Tomlinson. Tim is a professor at the Stanford Business School, where he teaches a very popular class on software as a service. In fact, I've taken your class, Tim, and you bring in some incredible speakers and make it very entertaining. But Tim is also has a distinguished career in the private sector. He was the president of Oracle's on-demand service, which by some records was the first online on-demand service. And, you know, cloud computing has a lot of fathers, but Tim is often called the grandfather of cloud computing because of that endeavor. But Tim is also an investor in cloud computing companies and an author of some very, very exciting cloud computing books. So thank you, Tim, for being here.
Thank you.
Next, we have Simon Crosby. Simon is a serial entrepreneur and has just launched his latest company called Bromium, and he might actually tell us a little bit about it. But Simon is the CTO and founder of Bromium. Before that, almost just about a month ago, he was the CTO of Citrix Systems. And Simon got to Citrix by selling his last company, ZenSource, to Citrix. And ZenSource, as some of you might know, has developed some of the key virtualization technologies which are the enablers for cloud. So again, Simon, you made a big contribution through your startup and then Citrix towards the cloud, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
And last but definitely not the least, we have Gina Tomlinson, who is the CTO of our very old, dear city of San Francisco. Gina is responsible for the technology direction for the Department of Technology for the city of San Francisco. And Gina has had a very daunting task of taking the legacy infrastructure of the city and moving that to a professional data center, and she's moved some of her data center needs to our data center. Thank you for that, Gina. But also also setting up, you know, a virtual private cloud and making a foray into the public cloud. So she'll actually provide a very unique perspective as a large government user on cloud computing. Gina was also the CIO of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority, yes. And she was also managing Clorox's data centers previously. So thank you, Gina, for being here.
Thank you.
So I, with so much brain power and perspective in this room, I'm actually going to ask each of our panelists, we can start with you, Tim, to take about 4 or 5 minutes and give us a landscape of where you think cloud computing is today and where do you see it going.
This venue with these microphones makes you feel like you must, what Rupert Murdoch must have felt like this morning. I have no direct knowledge of the cloud. Anyway, let me make a small correction since my academic colleagues, I'm sensitive to this. I am a lecturer at Stanford University, not a professor. That's another level of this conversation. So let me just extend the introduction a little bit. One of the things I did after I left Oracle was I had actually taught for many years at Stanford as I tell the kids real stuff. And so I did go back to Stanford and start up a class on cloud computing. I actually, 3 years ago, started a class at Tsinghua University in Beijing as well in this subject because I feel it's really important. We are, in my opinion, in the second year of a 20-year cycle that is no different than the client-server cycle that happened last time around, and I think education is an important component of this. So I'm going to take my 4 or 5 minutes to educate you guys a little bit on what is this thing we call cloud computing. I'm going to try to use as much plain English as I can and leave all the technical buzzwords aside and try to illuminate for you why is happening is important. And fundamentally, it's an economic thing that's happening, and that is what has always driven technology is economics, and I'll get to that specifically in a minute. So I do a lot of public speaking. Actually, I was just counting today because I had to do something this morning. I've actually, over the past 6 months, talked to 5,000 people about cloud computing. So what I try to do with them and what I'm going to try to do with you is try to explain cloud computing in a way that you can explain to your Facebook friends. So let me start with we all use cloud computing. We all use consumer application cloud services. Okay, so whether you're using Twitter, Facebook, eBay, Google, Amazon, et cetera, you are using consumer application cloud services. Now, just so we realize how far we've transitioned, I was with a Stanford kid about 2 months ago, and I'm giving her the little lecture on, like, what is cloud computing. And I start that way. And I said, well, you know, once upon a time, consumer applications you used to get and install on your PC and, you know, update and all that. And she looks at me and says, oh, yeah, I've heard of this thing. Isn't it called a floppy disk? So, right, we've completely transitioned for consumer applications, right? What many of you guys in the room probably don't know is on the business application front, this has similarly happened in a very different way. So nearly every business application, when I'm talking about business applications, I'm talking about financial, customer relationship systems, purchasing, HR, web analytics, all the things that businesses use, all the software businesses use to automate their businesses. What you may not know is in the past 10 years, every business application software company which has gone public has been delivered as a cloud service. Okay, nobody does it in the new world the old way anymore. It's all delivered as cloud service. So this ranges from, I mean, many of you are in San Francisco. You know who Salesforce is. Salesforce has been a huge leader in this. But even in the whole Bay Area, I mean, you have NetSuite, who's delivering CRM and ERP, Taleo, SuccessFactors, Vocus, Omniture, I mean, as I said, nearly everyone. And I'll give you one example which you all are probably familiar with, which you'll think is kind of an odd example, which is OpenTable, right? I'm guessing because San Francisco's ground zero, right? I mean, you all use OpenTable. Now, what I want you to point out is on the one hand, you see OpenTable as a consumer application cloud service, right? You go on and we reserve restaurant space, whatever. It's free, all that. But the other side of OpenTable is a business application, right? They are selling to restaurants, right, software to help them increase their number of people that show up in the restaurant, et cetera. So it is a business application cloud service, right, as well. So that has happened really within the past 10 years, right? And as I said, every application. And increasingly what is happening is highly specialized applications. So I'll give you one example of that. DealerTrack actually does loan origination software for automotive loans, and today basically 80% of all the loans in the United States are processed through their software, okay? And We will see much, much more of this. If we wanted to talk about non-public companies, I mean, it'd be tons and tons of this. Okay, so business application cloud services. Every one of these guys uses the original cloud service. So a lot of people have asked me, well, why do we call it a cloud, right? I mean, what's this come from? It's pretty simple. You know, in the old days of client-server computing, some of us were around then, we draw a picture of a PC, we draw a picture of a Unix server, and we draw a little cloud in between, mostly because none of us understood how networks worked. So this was our explanation, you know, that, well, you connect, right? Now, for the old folks in the room, you may remember words like SNA, BNA, X25, SDLC, frame relay. I mean, I can keep rattling this stuff on. This is all communication technology that was developed for corporations to build their own networks. Now, that sounds like crazy talk today, right? Nobody does that anymore. Everybody is using IP, MPLS-based networks from AT&T, Sprint, blah, 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 right? So that's the network cloud. The network guys realized that in order to build a network service, they had to put these things called switches and routers in a room that had high-quality power, guard dogs out front, and not located on a fault line, right? Hence the advent of data centers, right? Data center cloud services. And there have been many, many companies enter into this market. It is not a trivial market to enter. The cost of building these things, by the way, is $1,000 per square foot, which is expensive even by California standards, right? And cost of power, by the way, dominates this, right? This has been a very interesting space for a whole variety of reasons, and I'm going to leave it there, but data center cloud services is the other component that is being delivered, right? Finally, I'm going to introduce you to two last things. The first is something that happened very innovative about 5 years ago when Jeff Bezos out of Amazon introduced this idea of I'm going to deliver you compute, a computer, and storage as a cloud service. Okay? Compute and storage. And everybody thought, like, Jeff, you're Looney Tunes, right? You sell books and CDs and DVDs. Like, why the hell are you doing this, right? Oh, can I say that word? You can edit it out. Why are you doing this, right? Well, no, they have not released public numbers, but their compute and storage cloud service at this point in time is widely believed to be at a $1 billion run rate in 5 years, which is meteoric growth in this business, which is why basically everybody and their brother has entered into this marketplace, right? What, from the little guys, you know, people you probably have never heard of, like Lair Technology and GoGrid and Joint and people like that, all the way to the big boys in the room like Microsoft, et cetera, IBM, EMC. And we have not seen the end of this story, okay? Because, by the way, for applications, they're very unique to some specific need. When you talk about computers and storage, every one of us uses it, okay? So compute and storage cloud services. The last two things that are happening, and this is very new right now, is software development cloud services. So actually, for those of you in the room who aspire to or have built software, building software in a world where the amount of time from the time I come up with the idea to the time it's running in production is measured in days or weeks and not years, right? The whole development infrastructure is completely different, right? And how I go about doing that. This is a very nascent space at this stage. There's names out there. Since we're in San Francisco, like Force.com's been doing stuff here. Heroku, Microsoft's Azure, et cetera. Google's App Engine, not to leave Google out of the story, right? Lots and lots of stuff happening here. By the way, this is going to ignite the whole thing because that's what happened last time. The guy who ignited client-server was the developer, okay? Last thing, operations management. You may never have managed, she can say this, when you manage applications, right, you have to manage the security, the availability, the performance, the changes, the problems in that software that you bought. You can choose to do that with manual labor, which is painful and very expensive, or you can start to use software to help you do that, okay? That has been going on for years in operations management software. What is new happening right now is all of that software is now being delivered as a cloud service. So I'll give you a very simple example. Once upon a time, if you wanted to make sure that you had no spam on your site, you bought spam filtering software, installed it on a PC, managed it, blah, blah, blah. Today, nobody does that, right? You go and buy Postini spam filtering from Google or Symantec. I mean, it comes from a variety of people. So this space is enormous, and it has just started up, right? So across the board, I'll end by saying we're in year two of a 20-year cycle. This cycle is no different than what we saw with client-server. In fact, for the old people in the room, and I'm one of them, I will tell you, I have heard all the same things that we used to say during that era, which is people say, well, you're never going to want to run on Unix. You know, you're never, it's not scalable. It's not reliable. You're never going to run on Oracle database. Oh, my God, you know, that's not secure. It's not performant, et cetera. Okay, for the technical people in the room, was Unix a better, technologically better system than MBS? Was DB2, was Oracle better than DB2 technologically? The answer to these, I'll tell you, is no. They were not technologically better. What they were economically better. And it's the massive difference in the economics of this which has driven every stage of computing here. And that is what is going to drive this forward. I will end by letting you, if there's one thing I want you to walk away with, I'm going to tell you a little story, then I'll pass it back. So as I said, I teach a class at Tsinghua University, and so the Amazon boys are very nice to me, and so they gave me $3,000 worth of compute and storage, right? So I showed up in class, and I said, hey, you have $3,000 worth of compute and storage. Turns out that buys you about 2.5 years of a server, and you can pick, you know, Northern California, Virginia, you know, Ireland, right? Okay, so most of the kids in the room are looking at me going, well, that's kind of, you know, boring. So what, right? I can get a server in Beijing. What difference does it make, right? I said, well, yeah, I agree with you. I said, or $3,000 buys you 10,000 computers for 30 minutes. 10,000 computers for 30 minutes for $3,000. Nobody has ever been given 10,000 computers for 30 minutes for $3,000. And it is in the question that they looked at me at that stage and went, what would I do with that? That is the seed of the next step. There are lots and lots of examples already happening around this, but this is the magic, because as soon as the smart kids out there start figuring out what you do with 10,000, we ignite this thing with a rocket ship. This has nothing to do with, you know, total cost of ownership or any of that stuff. It has to do with being able to do things we economically could never do before. So I will conclude. I cede the floor.
Thank you, Tim. Simon.
Well, now you know all about cloud computing. Let me give you a slightly different angle on this. I think of the cloud as being roughly categorized into two worlds. There's the cloud as envisaged and manifested within the enterprise, which includes the city of San Francisco, large organizations of people who have IT needs. And then there's another kind of cloud, which is the cloud that's in your pockets, which is most of what Tim spoke to, although he did mention some enterprise apps. So every one of us walks into our job every day with a cloud in our pocket. Okay? That's the apps that sit on your smart device, and you are driving cloud adoption far faster than enterprise IT can adopt anything. Actually, most enterprise IT shops are still sitting on something like Windows 2003, if you're lucky. And so there's this huge challenge that cloud presents, which is that we as consumers are delighted by this fabulous experience. We're delighted to innovate upon it, and that's why you see all this amazing innovation on top of new form factor devices like tablets and smartphones. And yet the real world, which is the world in which we live, absolutely sucks from a user experience. And we are in this horrible position whereby we as consumers are driving this incredible rate of change for our enterprise employers. And whilst you might be quite happy to publish anything about yourself and your family on Facebook or Twitter or anywhere else where you happen to choose to do it, the government is definitely not happy with you putting corporate stuff or government stuff up there too. And so we as consumers are driving this phenomenal rate of change. The growth rate in the public cloud market is around about 60 to 70% just in terms of server count. It's certainly north of 100% per year in terms of bandwidth requirements for the public internet right now. And so we're consuming things, and that's all fab. The problem is that we as humans in the rest of our lives, the bit that kicks out money and drives the economy, actually deal with today's enterprise applications. None of them run in the cloud. They're subject to regulatory compliance, and your desktop has got nothing to do with the cloud at all. And so the challenge is that cloud really is leading this enormous change on the enterprise IT environment. So let's call it broadly the consumerization of IT. The problem that brings is that whilst you're happily wandering into the enterprise every day with this cloud in your pocket, which is your stuff, your friends, your contacts, your world, your milieu, your apps, a whole bunch of that actually belongs to somebody else. It belongs to another interest, maybe multiple interests. And so your personal consumption of cloud is quite literally a threat to your employer. Let's be very clear. The very recent publicized attacks against RSA were the key seeds for RSA's secure access technology were stolen. The attacks on Google, the attacks published just this week against U.S. defense interests were initiated from users like you. Okay? Humans like you who clicked on a URL, clicked on an attachment in an email, and let the bad guys in. And so for most of the enterprise world, the public cloud is nothing more than a menace. Yet we see its clear benefits. We see its enormous cost advantages. We see all of these wonderful things that Tim told you about. And so the challenge really is to try and evolve what today in enterprise IT is a process built around people. People and process and regulation that tries to keep us safe, tries to run our economy, and translate it into something that is more efficient, that takes advantage in evolution of revolution of technology, arguably, but doesn't hand out, well, doesn't toss out the baby with the bathwater. And that is the big challenge of cloud. So whilst I'm a happy user of a tablet device and everything else, I think that's kind of ho-hum. I mean, it's fabulous that you can build a startup in your garage again. You don't have to buy servers. But the real challenge is, how do we adopt this technology in a world where the rate of adoption is governed not by anything to do with technology itself, but by the rate at which humans can evolve their skill sets as they face new technologies? And that is what enterprise IT is. So I can tell you with absolute confidence that the rate at which enterprise IT will adopt cloud is the rate at which we can retire legacy skill sets from the enterprise IT department. Okay? We need to get newer people in, and we need to upgrade the skill set. So let me try and describe this in a slightly different way. The only thing that's interesting in tech is Moore's Law. It's an exponential curve. We see it plotted as a line. It's an exponential. It's a curve, and it doubles. And whilst we, in our human experience, live in linear time with linear skill sets, thinking what to do tomorrow, by the time tomorrow comes, technology has moved the world ahead a whole lot more than we could ever grasp. Mm-hmm. And so here we sit as humans in some roughly sort of 20th century experience of what computer systems and networks and so on are. And the world is radically different in terms of innovation. The challenge is, how do you get humans to evolve quicker to adopt these technologies and to do so in a way that is safe and secure? And that, for me, is the challenge of cloud.
Very nice, Simon. In fact, that leads just into Gina, because she grapples with these problems every day.
Every day. Let me first start by saying that I feel far more at ease now being in this prestigious venue after hearing hell and sucks, and I can, I'm far more at ease. I feel far more at home now, so I can speak to you very plainly. With my esteemed colleagues here, these guys, I'm very humbled being here with these folks, because these folks are actually architects of the technology and architects of the cloud computing technology in and of itself. So I'm humbled to be here with these gentlemen. I can speak from a so I'm merely a purveyor of the technology that they implemented. I can speak from my role with the city and county of San Francisco and how we are leveraging cloud and the benefits that we're deriving from the cloud and why we made the choices therein. Certainly, as Tim alluded to, the choice to go to the cloud was primarily cost-driven, economic-driven, no question. But also, we began to see that the city business, the city government was changing, and the role of city government was changing. The constituents in the city and county are very savvy computer users. San Francisco is the gateway to Silicon Valley. So the constituents within the city and county of San Francisco demand more change, demand more availability, demand more accessibility. And so while the public sector is renowned for being slow and moving slow to adopt change and slow to implement change, the constituents of the city and county in San Francisco demanded more. So we had to be able to deliver services in a speedier manner, in a more cost-effective manner, while still embracing many of the legacy systems and staff and processes throughout the city. San Francisco is a very unique city in terms of, you know, we embrace history. We embrace legacy. We embrace our cable cars. We embrace our wonderful Victorians that we have here. So our history is very important to us, that legacy. But we also, do a complete 180, we have a huge interface and awareness of technology. So many technological advantages started here. And we have to embrace that here as a city. So why do we leverage cloud? One, obviously from an economical position, but two, because we're able to deliver services more quickly. We have a challenge with our staffing and resources, as you mentioned, but we have to embrace that legacy staff. We can't merely replace them, as you pointed out. We have to embrace that legacy staff and repurpose them in other areas that we can benefit in the city better with those folks. So our decision to recently go to a more enterprise version of the cloud computing with leveraging email in the cloud, that was a major decision, a groundbreaking decision for the city and county, but one that we feel that will better prepare us for the future and better enable us to implement other technologies to help move the city forward and to help uplift the technical maturity within the city. And that's what we're charged to do as a IT organization within the city. And to your comment earlier, Abhijit, it's something that we face every day, a challenge that we face every day, leveraging legacy, respecting legacy, yet implementing technology to meet the needs of the business of the city and the needs of the constituents within the city.
Thank you, Gina. In fact, I'm going to just dive straight into Gina, a question for you, because when you say cloud, there are multiple models of the cloud, and let me simplify them in three models which Gina has recently used. One is where instead of building your own data center, which companies would do 10 years ago, and you build your own computer room and your generators and your air conditioning, you go use an outsourced professional data center and you outsource that. So that's one move to the core, which is one move to the cloud. Mm-hmm. The second model, which, Gina, you have used, is you've actually used virtualization to set up a massive private cloud where you can now provision servers on demand for your constituents within the city. And in the context of a government with the compliance issues and the security issues and mission-critical services which you overlay, that is quite an achievement. So that is the second model which you have embarked on. And the third model is clearly the public cloud, where you made a decision to move some of your data to a public cloud email.
Yes.
If you could talk about the decision process which led to selecting each of them, your concerns, your challenges, and also the economics behind each of those models, I think it would be very beneficial.
Okay. Well, our decision to leverage your services or move to a co-location facility here in the city was pretty simple, and that was pretty much a cost decision as well. The decision to build a brand new data center from the ground up versus leverage the services of a prefabricated co-location center that it's already outfitted with all the HVAC, heating and air conditioning and cooling facilities that we need. Power, electricity. After weighing the cost of such, it was an easy choice and most cost-effective choice to seek out the services of a co-location site for the city and county's primary data center. Our former data center, we looked at ways to possibly renovate and upgrade the facility there, And it just, from a cost perspective, it wasn't a benefit to the city, and we didn't think it was a fair use of the city's taxpayers' funds. So we felt that it was best to research a co-location facility here in the city. And we're very pleased with it, with our decision to go that route, because one, we didn't have to. We no longer had the responsibility of managing a facility. We could repurpose or refocus those efforts that we had with our staff performing those services before. We can now repurpose those folks into other areas of the organization, teaching them a new skill set. And we no longer had the burden, frankly, of facility management. We no longer had to stress our resources in any of the facility-based type of management responsibilities. So that was a clear economics choice for us. Our decision to go to an enterprise mail solution there was certainly a long-term cost associated with that, but our decision to go to Microsoft cloud solution was based on several factors, one of which being the availability of the constant availability and reliability and performance of Microsoft, the availability to have the actual email application hosted in the cloud took that burden off of our staffing resources. We had limited resources in the city to manage our 25,000 user base, and the yearly staffing cost and staffing time and resources in managing the email application on site and on premise continued to build each year. And our staffing resources, due to city budget cuts and deficits and reductions in force each year, we were less able to maintain the quality of service from an email support perspective. So we did not want to impinge or degrade the level of email service or the quality of service that we were providing the city and county. So we had to look for a solution that would allow us to maintain a quality of service, maintain the availability and reliability of email here in the city and county, and also to get us all on the same one single solution for the city and county. Prior to our decision to move to the cloud, many of our city agencies were on the disparate email systems. So we weren't able to effectively communicate. All 25,000 of us were communicating in different areas in different ways, and we wanted to be more collaborative. We wanted to be able to communicate in a more uniform manner, and we felt that a single solution in the cloud was the best option for us.
Thank you, Gina. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go to Tim, because, you know, cloud is often called a technology. I've heard Tim call it a business model. And he's written a very popular book which compares all the different software business models. Tim, tell us why you feel that way.
Well, let me just actually, I'm going to make one comment before that, because, you know, a lot of people have discussed whether or not corporations are going to use the cloud, right? Is this ever going to really happen? Mm-hmm. So I actually did a thing. I had to do a talk about a year and a half ago to 40 of the largest company CIOs on the planet, like you'd know all their names. And I happen to know a lot of CEOs of guys who are delivering, remember I said business application cloud services, so like Salesforce, NetSuite, Focus, all these companies. So I sent the list, because I knew who was going to be in the room, to all of my buddies, and I said, well, who are these are your customers, right? So I aggregated all the data. So anybody want to guess, out of 40 of the largest companies in the world, how many of them were using one or more of these? There was about 7 different applications, all delivered out of the cloud, all of them. All right, we'll play Price is Right rules. Best guess, not over. So that's over. 89%. Well, that's probably pretty close. 38 out of 40 of the largest companies in the world were using one or more of these. So when we debate this question of will corporations use the cloud, I mean, I'd say they already have. I mean, mm-hmm. We clearly are still in early adoption phase. I mean, I could actually rattle off some very interesting stories right now of companies you know right now who are using
lots of interesting compute and storage cloud services as well.
Okay.
So I just wanted to kind of get people to start to think. Yep. Companies are moving this way. In fact, there's a Bay Area company, I won't name names, but actually the CFO has walked in the CIO's office. This is a very large company, and said, no more capital expenditure. It's all OpEx, right, for you all you finance people in the room. Okay. To answer your question, the reason why I talk about this as a business model is, and by the way, I'd be happy to send any of you guys a copy of this book, so just give me a business card and we'll send it to you. Or if you want EPUB versions, we can do that. And I'm not going to try to do the lecture on all seven different business models, but as he said, I have tried to break down what has happened in the entire software business into seven fundamental business models that are very different economically. The reason why I talk about cloud computing being a business model, I'm going to go square to the story of compute and storage and say that Amazon, and I'll pick on Brother Amazon, Amazon's innovation was not technology. It was not technology. They have to use virtualization. In fact, they use his virtualization technology. They have to use virtualization technology to enable what they're doing, but their innovation was not virtualization. In fact, for the old people in the room, I mean, IBM did this in 1972, right? Their innovation was 12 cents an hour.
Right. Mm-hmm.
12 cents an hour. And transparently, like we can go right now and look it up. You know, you can buy it for 12 cents an hour. And that ability to sell you, and they're not the only ones. I mean, Brother Microsoft's starting to do this. Other people, Rackspace starting to do, other people are starting to do this because it's so transparent, by the way. But that innovation to give you a computer for 12 cents an hour, that's a business model innovation, right? And what that has spawned is a whole host of applications which, as I said in the opening comments, were economically not possible before. Let me just give you a simple example just for the fun of it. So some of you may not know this, but a couple years ago, and you know the Intuit guys probably don't want to talk about this, but a couple years ago, 350,000 people could not file their taxes on tax day. Okay? Not very good. You may not know this, but the number one day for e-cards on the planet is Valentine's Day. By a long shot, right? Hallmark processes more e-cards on Valentine's Day than any other day. This is because you don't send a Valentine on February 13th, and you certainly don't send one on February 15th, right? It's long gone. February 14th, right? Last interesting case for you to think about, 2 years ago, Super Bowl Sunday, Dockers and Denny's both ran giant ad campaigns, multi-million dollar Super Bowl ad campaigns, to drive people to their website, Dockers to get a free pair of pants, Denny's to get a free breakfast, okay? What you don't know is 1 minute after the Dockers ad ran, multi-million dollar ad campaign, the website fell down. Now, you didn't want to be the IT guy there, right? Okay. Furthermore, it is widely believed that the problem that they hit was found on the Denny's site a week before. Now, for those of you who are not technical in the room, I will tell you this problem could have been solved technologically, meaning you could have generated synthetically a ton of load coming from multiple sites around the United States to simulate every case I just told you about, whether that's Denny's, Dockers, Intuit's website, et cetera. You technologically could have done that. You could have bought computers, put them in Miami, San Francisco, L.A., et cetera, ramped up a ton of work to go hit these websites. You could have done it technologically. Economically, it would have cost you like an arm and a leg to go do this. And so, which is why nobody did it. Now, maybe the guys at Docker should have, but nobody did it. Now, today, there's a whole host of guys that are going, well, wait a minute, right? Would you like 10,000 computers for 3 days to generate a ton of synthetic load and hit all these giant websites? You can have that, and you only need to buy it for 3 days because they have delivered. Amazon, among others, has done this. If you want to be a student of this, get to be a student of what they're doing with business models. So there's, just quickly, so you guys can think about it, there's what they call on-demand pricing, 12 cents per hour. They have this concept called reserve pricing, meaning if you think you're going to use it for a year, you know, pay me a little bit up front and I'll take the hourly rate down. And then they have this fascinating concept called spot pricing, right, which means at every hour, this hour, we can all go bid on whatever excess capacity there is. And if you're the high bidder, you get it. There are a lot of interesting applications for this, by the way. And by the way, this innovation and business model, in my opinion, has not stopped. They've led this thing, but it's not over, right? Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the holy grail here, is this technology he built, is going to enable people to build business models which we've never seen and economically allow things to happen which we've never seen. Was that a short answer or long?
That was just right, Tim. Thank you. In fact, my next question leads into that with Simon. Simon, you have invented, developed, some core virtualization technology. You've seen it being used both in private clouds, in the enterprise setting, in public clouds. How do you see customers reacting to both private versus public clouds, the challenges, the opportunities?
Most CIOs are trying to build a private cloud.
Why?
Because of all the scary things out there, and because they've got real humans who are kind of scared of letting go of control. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that it's not so much a technology challenge as a human process challenge. Mm-hmm. It is really scary to let go of this thing that you have been chartered with looking after. Mm-hmm. And so it could be a regulatory requirement, but it could just be that your job is built around mm-hmm. making this thing work. Mm-hmm. And so we have a skill set issue too. And so, and in general, CIOs would tell you they're building a private cloud for security reasons and a bunch of other things. In general, it is absolutely in IT's interest, mm-hmm. existing IT people's interest, to build a private cloud because they get to keep their jobs. Let's just put it nice and simply. Yep. And so if they are, they're off doing that. But the broader concern that's articulated is one of security and control.
Yep.
And the public cloud is then generally branded by the enterprise segment as being untrustworthy, unless it is backed by a particular promise, mm-hmm. perhaps a major corporate brand like Microsoft or mm-hmm. Google or whatever. And what's been lacking there has been standards related to a customer's ability to reason about the security of a cloud. Mm-hmm. What we have is some very good anecdotal evidence that people who focus on building clouds for a living will do a far better job than you would ever if you were building your own IT system. A good way of thinking about this would be if you look back on WikiLeaks and the stuff that followed, WikiLeaks turned out was hosting the website on Amazon. And when Amazon pulled that, Anonymous launched an attack on a whole bunch of different sites. They launched them on PayPal, Visa, MasterCard, and a bunch of other folks, and on AWS. And everybody who was running their own data center was down in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so here's statement one. If you're running your own thing, you will be taken out much more easily than if you're running as part of a much larger aggregated whole where that cloud provider can defend that property much more rigorously. Mm-hmm. And goodness me, they care about defending it. But more importantly, through automation, you get to get an assurance that data is less accessible. So people will say to me that, if they build a private cloud and surround it with people, then they're much more secure. That is patently false because, people trip over cables. So things fail. Mm-hmm. But people also have USB keys and they walk off with your data. Mm-hmm. And this is very well known. Whereas if things are highly automated and unguessable by humans, mm-hmm. you have a much better shot at it. Mm-hmm. Again, go back to WikiLeaks. The data should never have been there and the guy shouldn't have been able to download it onto a USB key. That's a human problem and a failure of human systems. There was alerting built in and people were not looking at a human log saying, hey, this guy's downloading all your files. So when you leave it to humans, we're bound to make mistakes. When we leave it to humans, humans are, we're inclined to believe. We're inclined to seek fun, And so when we look at the security angle of it, security designers always believe that users are prepared to trade security for functionality or just for fun. You know what? I tell you what. If you give a user a dancing pig or something even more than that, they will click on a dancing pig any day. And so the problem is that we're gullible and therefore we render our enterprises vulnerable to attack. And so the human nature of most of the attacks are actually social engineering. And so, the challenge is that your private cloud might be well fortified. In general, very few attacks come in to the data center. They generally come in on the basis of compromised clients. And so what you'll find in, for example, the Google attack, somebody clicked on a poisoned Internet Explorer 6 URL, whammo. That was it for Google. And why on earth was Google using Internet Explorer 6, you might think? That's an interesting question. But they were. Okay. So the enterprise is building private clouds. And I think the next step beyond getting out of the infrastructure business, that is owning facilities, is to get into the business of trusting a vendor who has already owns the facilities and build servers, server farms, pre-installed with all the goo to make them automated. Mm-hmm. Let's just call that a hosted private cloud.
Yes.
The model there that's talked about sometimes is called hybrid cloud. That is, I have some stuff privately in my own facilities, where I already have set up, and then I'll have a hybrid cloud where some of it is run by somebody else. And that's very clearly where the enterprise is aiming for next. There are challenges, by the way, in general, as the enterprise has to adopt the cloud. Let me run through some of them. The moment you want to access an application which is running outside your prem, it's not clear what the user's identity is. Let's be clear. The enterprise is exploding both at the front and the back. By the front, I mean we all want to sit in Starbucks and work. So the enterprise network is no longer there.
True.
Okay, so we're all accessing stuff over the public internet. And then at the back, the enterprise is adopting these cloud services, whether it be a private compute cloud or whether it be a SaaS thing, CRM app. The challenge out the back is that the enterprise has vested interest based on identity. So I, sitting in Starbucks, want to go to, let's just say, Salesforce.com. Whose identity am I doing that under? Does the enterprise give me one? In which case, gosh, can I just go there and once they fire me, steal all the data and walk out the door again, right? And so this whole problem is that security is tied to identity. The moment you step outside the enterprise boundary, the identity is up for grabs. And so extending the enterprise boundary, extending the enterprise into the cloud is a major challenge. We have to extend not only identity management, but also all of the requirements for security, compliance, and various other things. So the adoption of SaaS and various cloud services, notwithstanding, it's growing apace. There are major challenges still just technologically to get it done. So the enterprise views public cloud as untrustworthy, unreliable, and scary, and yet every single enterprise employee uses it on the enterprise client and on their own.
Yep.
So the employee walks in with their own network nowadays and their own apps, and they process enterprise data on that device, and they probably drag it into something like Dropbox.
Yep.
And so, look, you know, Tim mentioned a very interesting statistic of how many people said they were using cloud. I'm telling you, the only thing that's interesting is CIOs who don't know that they are using every form of cloud that is available. Okay, and this is the challenge again, is that the employee wants to be productive, just a well-intentioned employee wanting to be productive,
yes.
You know, gets around trying to send an email to a colleague and bounces off of the email limit, right? And so they drag it into Dropbox and send a public link. And suddenly all of your data is in the cloud, whether you liked it or not, and the CIO has no clue. All right, so the consumerization challenge is the challenge for the adoption of cloud. And then, you know, broadly from an automation perspective, it is absolutely the case that further automation builds you a much more reliable cloud service. I happen to be a passionate fan of the models being built by public cloud providers because their entire business depends on doing a good job. And so you can bet that they'll have far more highly incentivized people, but fewer people, and mm-hmm. lots more software to run those systems. Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that perspective. As a practical reality, we see customers come to us every day saying that, hey, listen, we can go to the public cloud, but for all of these concerns, we are just as good being in a private cloud, and you, company who's done this 100 times, do this for us, and the economics is not that different at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. But one of the very nice things is you can move consumption from this CapEx model to consumption model,
yes,
which is really important. I think that's a key change for IT, is that you no longer have to buy stuff and stand it up and pay for software licenses. You can simply rent them.
Yes.
And that is a phenomenal change for IT because you're then consumption-based instead of CapEx-based.
Which is then my final question to all three panelists, and this is really, where is the future of cloud computing going? I mean, is this really going to be an instant gratification engine where, as you mentioned, the power of the infinite comes into the hand of a single individual? Or is this a way of life? Gina?
I think it's a way of life. Assuming on what Tim said earlier about this, we're only on the second year of a 20-year wave. I think 20 years is conservative. I think this is what we're moving to as information technology initiative. This is what the future holds now for us. I believe that the years of the time of infrastructure management and procurement of infrastructure, that time is surely waning. It's waning today. I mean, if you look at some of the budget models and some of the forecasts of some of the perennial infrastructure companies, HP, Dell, they'll all tell you that the sales of their PCs and servers have decreased significantly just within this two-year time period. So if we're making this type of progress and growth just within in the past 2 to 3 years, what happens year 5? What happens year 10? So I think to your earlier point, many of the common everyday services and tasks that we do every day will all be in the cloud. So much of it is today already, but I think much more. I think one thing that it will continue to, it will actually reach into the home more than it already has. I think that is where the next advent of this will be. It's already pervasive in business. I think it will in some way reach into the home, into the consumer, and even more directly touch the consumer within their home.
So I confidently predict that employees will be bringing their own devices. That will be an assumption, just as you bring a pen into work to write. You know, you'll bring in your own device, and it'll be a confident expectation that employers will stop providing enterprise devices in the not too distant future, simply because there's no reason for them to do that. And then from the adoption of cloud computing perspective, for sure, it's going fast. It's going incredibly fast. I think there are a couple of things I can say with absolute confidence. There will be more lines of COBOL by the time we leave this room than when we stepped into it. Okay. Legacy businesses are great businesses, and legacies live for a long time. Legacies live as a factor of human time, yes. Not as a matter of technology. So technology can do the coolest stuff on the planet. It's what humans do with technology that matters. And so there'll be more Windows.net programs and all of that stuff, just as there was. And so the legacy will remain. And what's driving public cloud today is predominantly consumer experience. And that is growing incredibly fast. Of course, we're all getting new devices all the time. The fundamental change for IT as these new devices come in is that instead of having to maintain their own copy of Windows the way they always used to, gosh, AT&T's doing that for them now. It's brilliant.
Right.
That's why they get out of owning the client eventually, right? Mm-hmm. Because they don't have to service that thing on the device. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the consumerization is really helping IT and I think can really move the whole computing experience forward whilst preserving a way for people to access legacy desktops and legacy applications in a, you know, using various technologies that can be cloudified too.
Thank you, Simon. Tim.
I'm going to go right turn on this. So let me start you guys with something for you to think about. So 80% of the U.S. economy is a service economy, right? So we don't manufacture anything. We don't grow anything, right? We're a service economy. You've probably heard this. One of the things, and probably every one of you in this room is in the service economy. You probably are not growing anything or manufacturing anything. The question I would put in front of you is, what the hell is a service business? What is a service economy, right? Okay, is it answering the phone nicely? Is that a service business? Is it, you know, flipping burgers at In-N-Out? I get to say that around here, right? Is that a service business? All right, I will contend to you that a service business is a business which delivers information that is personal and relevant to you. Information is personal and relevant to you. So whether that means I go down to the Mark Hopkins or whatever and I talk to the concierge and I go, you know, I really would like to find a cheap Chinese restaurant that I can walk to that's less than $5 and serves Sichuan food, right? And he gives me the right answer, or she gives me the right answer. Or I go in my doctor's office, and he says, well, you know, based on your genome and your lifestyle, you know, we really need to put you on Lipitor, and you really need to exercise more, right? That is service, right? Now, let me take you to computers, and let me visualize the Amazon website for a second, okay? Now, what are they trying to do there? They are trying to deliver you information that's personal to you, right? People like you bought this book. People like you listened to this music, whatever, right? I will ask you a question for the technical people in the room. Where is the transaction processing system on that web page? Well, I'll tell you the answer. It's that little shopping cart in the upper right-hand corner. Now, most of us in the tech field, and I've been around for a while, we've all worked on the shopping cart. We've all worked on transaction processing systems, payment, high integrity, high transaction throughput, blah, blah, blah. That's all we've worked on as an entire freaking industry, right, is those transactional systems. How important is it on that website? Well, I'll tell you, yeah, it has to work at scale and all that, but it ain't very important, right? What is important on that site is they're trying to deliver information that's personal to you. Now, let's take it to, let's pick our favorite banking website, so Wells or whatever, Wachovia, B of A, right? Go to the website. You have to log in, right? From that point on, all you see is a transaction processing system, mm-hmm. right? All it's trying to do is go, can you debit and credit and, you know, buy stock and whatnot? It doesn't actually care who you are. It has no idea who you are. Now, by the way, have you ever thought about this? The consumer internet, Google, blah, 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 sees is 200 terabytes. That's all it is. Not very big, right, really. Every business, you guys work in businesses all around here, every business has, the city has 10x the amount of data that is sitting on the consumer internet. The challenge is, how do you get it? How do you take that information and make it personal and relevant to you? I'll give you a trivial example of this, and I'm going to regret this one day because I always say it this way. I hate shopping at Home Depot. Okay? It's like, I don't really like going there. However, think about this scenario. What if, you know, 3 weeks ago I bought a tile, and 2 weeks ago I bought a faucet, and last week I bought a sink, and this week I bought a vanity mirror. What am I doing? I'm probably remodeling my bathroom, right? Well, by the way, they also could know that, oh, I've actually spent $10,000 over the past 4 months at Home Depot. Well, with all that information there, why isn't the manager showing up when I show up at Home Depot showing me the three toilets that would match, right, my tile? My only point of this is all that information is there. It is not being harnessed to deliver information that is personal and relevant to you. This applies to financial systems. This applies to healthcare systems. It applies to city systems. It applies across the board. The major step that we are going to have, we will see, and people who innovate at this level will see, is doing that. And I'll end by telling you a little trivial metric for you to walk away think about. So, and it's called servers per employee. So all you guys that work in a business, just do this for fun. You go into the shop and say, well, how many servers do we have? Hey, big ones, little ones, I don't care, right, as you'll quickly realize. Divide by total number of employees, contractors, not contractors. Okay, got a number maybe in your head, some of you? Okay. Now, I'll give you a couple little data points. Turns out that the U.S. government actually tracks this for global economic development purposes. So because, by the way, if the number of servers per employee is zero, what's the chances for global economic development? About zero, right? So it turns out Brazil is at 0.04. India is at 0.02. I actually have no idea what the U.S. is at, right? Okay, so that gives you some metric. My friends who run these application cloud service companies, they're sitting at 0.5 to 1.0, okay? Now, most of the people who listen to me who are CIOs of large companies, actually, I did this about 3 or 4 months ago. The guy sitting right here was the CIO of Kimberly-Clark. He's an old friend of mine. And so I said, Ramon, I said, how many servers per employee do you have? He goes, we have 0.4, and we're headed for 0.2. Proudly. Proudly. Okay. Who do you think is sitting at 30 to 1? Facebook. Who do you think is sitting at 50 to 1? And for you technical people in the room, do you think they're operating inefficiently? No, I don't think so. Furthermore, do you think that they're using all those servers to serve up web pages? Mm-mm. Right? These are truly information-powered businesses. And at the end of the day, my opinion, lots of people may share this, is all companies end up being information companies. All companies end up being software companies. I just did a keynote speech for a large German car company that you might know. And that is clearly, when you start realizing what they are starting to try to do, right, it's really, can we use all this cloud technology, take cost structures down, crush this down, so now I can change an 80-20 of 80% spent on a bunch of mundane stuff that other people can go do to 80-20, meaning 80% I get to build applications which power a very different experience. If you think about what the car of the future might look like, I mean, it's a freaking computer with four wheels, right? That's what it is. And what they're going to start to do with it, et cetera, right? It's completely different. And I'm talking about what we all conceptualize as a manufacturer even. So when you ask the question, what's going to happen in the future, It's harnessing this technology to really deliver a service economy. And the companies that do this, the guys that figure this out, they're going to be big winners, right? And they're going to change the way we think of them, the way we relate to them, the way we buy from them, all of that stuff, right? And that's what the future holds. I cede the floor.
Thank you. I think the best questions are yet to come, and we're going to turn it over to the audience.
Okay, so we'd like to remind our listening and viewing audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, The Future of Cloud Computing, with Timothy Chow, Simon Crosby, Gina Tomlinson, and Abhijit Fanse. Our thanks to our distinguished panel for their comments here today. Now we open the floor to a Q&A session. We'll be passing around the microphone, so if you have questions, please raise your hand and speak into the microphone.
I have a key question about a backup plan. You mentioned the Super Bowl earlier. What is the backup plan in the unlikely catastrophic event of a disabling of the system?
Yeah, maybe
solar storm or whatever.
Yeah, solar storm. There are lots of things that can go wrong. Meteorites can hit the planet, and then things go dark a bit. Maybe we fix it. Yeah. In general, the technology that you're talking about here is something which is broadly called cloud bursting, where essentially it's been widely used by Google and various other folks. If you go to google.com, there isn't one computer called google.com. There's a bazillion sitting behind this thing. So there's this concept which is load balancing across servers, and this has been augmented of late with an ability to dynamically spin up new instances of server applications in response to spikes in demand. So this general concept called cloud bursting allows you to do that. It allows you to do it across multiple cloud vendors, indeed. So you could do it across Amazon and Rackspace and various other people, so you can get geographic diversity and so on. And people who are doing this extremely well, for example, would be Netflix. And I'm sure many of you in this room use Netflix streaming capabilities. And what they do is they dynamically throw up new instances as more and more people click on movies that they want to watch. And so then what they're doing is, as the need scales, they then have the ability to, they then pay on the basis of consumption of that. And of course, it drops off as soon as the need drops off as well. And so they don't pay more than they're ever using, and they end up essentially paying for the average demand. And this technology is widely deployed around the world.
As kind of a follow-up, so individuals often use cloud services for backing up their computers. Are we about to see people using their computers to back up their cloud services to guarantee that they hold on to their data?
No, but certainly, you're at the tip of a very interesting iceberg, if I can try this. Go to 100,000 miles into space and look down the Earth. We're still driving more wavelengths down fiber, so there's no problem distributing content out to users. What we have a fundamental problem with is distribution of power, actually. Power is our dominating, in terms of distribution networks. So one of the reasons why building data centers doesn't make sense, because you're right out the end of the tree, you're a long way from distribution, you've got a lot of transmission loss, it's just senseless. So data centers move to where power gets generated. What's the next hardest thing to move? Big data. Data is still really hard to move, even though we have lots of wavelengths. And so that then says that the application moves to where the data is. And if you think about Facebook and their latest and Google and all of those folks, they build data centers right where the power is generated, typically near hydro plants and so on. And what you'll find is that more and more applications will move to where the data is, because moving those big chunks of data is very, very difficult. That's the big data category of apps. In terms of enterprises in the cloud, there is certainly no reason to suspect that the systems used by cloud vendors such as Amazon are not capable of geographic replication and redundancy. So it is absolutely the case that someone like Netflix, for example, can survive an outage of two simultaneous Amazon data centers through geographic redundancy and so on. So, this stuff exists, and the technology exists within the cloud providers to make sure that once your data gets there, it's not going away.
And it's just not a cloud provider solution. I mean, most enterprises will have things called disaster recovery, where they'll keep all their critical data on two U.S. coasts, let's say it's a U.S. company, completely synchronized so that if one coast gets hit by an earthquake or a terrorist attack, you've got the other coast. You can go get your data. And it's completely synchronized. It's always available. It's on demand. And it's, you know, so geographically diverse disaster recovery solutions have been in place for some time. And they actually do allow for secure data storage.
And I think that, I'm sorry, Tim, but I think that for the consumer, the individual consumer and home user, there's been this storage in the cloud and backing up your personal computer in the cloud has been burgeoning of late because people want to have the ability to store their files securely. But the reason why, to answer your question is why do they continue to still back up their cloud backup solution onto a USB stick or onto their own PCs is people still have to get comfortable with the idea of cloud security, that my data truly is secure up there and I'm comfortable with letting go. People still aren't quite comfortable with that concept yet. So I think as people become more and more confident and more comfortable with the concept of their data being safe, we will still have people and we still have instances where people want their data next to them, where they feel comfortable, where they feel safe and confident that their data is secure.
I think if I was purchasing services from a cloud vendor, I would mandate that all data at rest is encrypted using keys that I own, that I provide when it is processed for me. Okay, and there is no excuse for anybody not doing this. The technology exists. Mm-hmm. And so then it comes down to, well, what's the probability that a bad guy could go and guess the location? Now, in Amazon Web Services, you've got more than 3.5 billion objects, okay? They've got to know which one to go for. They've got to break your access. Then they've got to break the crypto on the objects. The probability of actually stealing your data and actually getting away with an attack is vanishingly small.
No, I think you addressed one of my concerns, which was the security of my data out on the cloud. But you raise an interesting question. Who owns my data? What if I do want it to go away? You say it doesn't go away and it's been replicated on thousands of centers.
There are very challenging concerns there. Notionally, well, certainly governed by state boundaries. So, for example, numerous Canadians don't want their data in American data centers in case, you know, under American Homeland Defense rules, that could be subject to inspection and seizure. And in Europe, Europe's made up of lots smaller places. You know, all of those regulations relate to national boundaries there too. And so the cloud providers actually end up having to meet numerous diverse regulatory requirements related to where data may reside and how it may be encrypted. There are different encryption standards for different agencies in different countries, and there are various standards related to that. So that is a major pain in their lives. I think Amazon wishes that they could, you know, make it go away the same way that they're trying to imagine that sales tax will go away one day.
But is it clear that I own my data? And is it clear
it
that
is,
if
but
I don't want you to mine it, you can't mine
it's
it?
It's clear that you own your data, but it's not clear that somebody with the appropriate search and seizure warrants cannot just make off with it too. And indeed they can. There was a recent... And of course, you know... So here's the scary one. The FBI said there's an attack coming out of those few racks over there. Let's just take all those racks.
Yep.
And they walked out with several companies' entire data, you know, their entire computer setup, just because some guy in one of those racks was doing a bad thing. That's scary.
Okay, unfortunately, we have time for only one last question. So whoever has the microphone, please.
maybe it's a mistake, but I have the microphone. I came to this lecture trying to find a lay definition of what cloud computing is.
Yes.
Maybe I understand it a little better, but I still don't have it in the simple terminology that I understand. And my other question is, from my point of view as a user of computing services, I've recently had the experience with a couple of banks going through a total change of their website, which caused me no end of aggravation and to try to continue my accessing of my data. And I had the feeling, and I think you kind of touched on this, that for maybe financial reasons or because you technology people are so influential in the world, you convinced these two banks they had to do this, it just really made my life miserable for a couple of weeks trying to figure out how to use their new system. Right. Now, I mean, it seems to me that, I've had the impression that technology people are sort of making work for themselves by influencing institutions that they need to change what they have already in place. And I still go by the old model: if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I'm posing these questions to this eminent panel.
Those are great observations. You know, I'm in my mid-40s by now, and there are programming languages that are used regularly in the cloud world that were, you know, that just didn't exist 5 years ago. And when you hear these guys talk, it's like gobbledygook to me. So here's the one thing: you get old with your music, you get old with your skill sets, you get old with your GUIs, and you know what? It's just the way it is, because we are a technology-driven society, and we have completely inverted the traditional way that societies were built, where when you were older, what you had learned was survival skill, and you were right. Okay, and that's the problem. When we're technology-driven, it's the young guys who are right, and the old guys take it in the neck. Now, cloud computing, let me try a very simple one for you. Used to be, in the old days, that everybody had their own electricity-generating plant.
That's good.
Okay, and this is the Nicholas Carr example. And people would generate electricity locally for their own production means, for their own factory, mill, coal plant, whatever it happened to be. That got turned into a utility. And the economics and the study of that is very interesting. There's a fabulous book by Nicholas Carr called The Big Switch, which basically tracks that history. But think of what cloud is doing to computing as being analogous. That is, instead of having to own and run your own software and hardware and computer systems, these things simply become services that you acquire by some horribly complicated plug, right? And so it becomes viable economically. In fact, the economics are compelling and the business models are compelling for various agencies to set up and run computing systems, applications, and various bits of infrastructure as a service for you that you can consume by plugging in. What do you got to plug into? Well, unfortunately, yes, it's still the case that you have to know too much, and we are pretty poor at that. But it is really that. It is that turning computation into a utility that can be consumed, as opposed to requiring humans to surround previous manifestations of the technology.
Okay. Our thanks to our distinguished panel for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening and viewing. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.